Sequoia presents Judging Dredd, 13 essays analyzing 2000 AD's most beloved and reviled character. Forward by Matt Smith. Interview with Rob Williams. Edited by Scott Weatherly. Find out who is the law.
Hi, I'm Mike Burton of Star Wars Comics and Canon and Genuine Chit Chat, and I'm here to talk to you guys about a new monthly show that's coming out on Comics in Motion very soon. Now, the show's going to be called the Comics in Motion Book Club, and it's specifically going to be tackling one-shots, mini-series, or small volumes of ongoing runs of comics. The idea behind it is a host, as well as a handful of guests, are going to sit down like an old school book club and talk about the comic, the narrative, their thoughts on it, the art style, and just generally all aspects of the comic in question. We would also love to hear from you guys on the show, so please make sure you send in your thoughts, your questions, or anything you'd like us to say on air, and you can contact us either on social media at comicsinmotionp, or you can email us at comicsinmotionpodcast@gmail.com. We're also going to have a rolling host, so it's going to be a different person each month, just so there's a nice big variety of the kind of comics that we tackle, and obviously the guests are going to change as well, so every month is going to be something different. I'm going to be the host of the first episode, and unsurprisingly, we are tackling a Star Wars comic. It's going to be the first volume of Darth Vader, Dark Lord of the Sith. It's the 2017 Darth Vader run, written by Charles Soule. We're going to be tackling issues 1 to 6 for the Chosen One arc, but the trade paperback collection is called The Imperial Machine. You can find this on Marvel Unlimited, and you can also find it on Hoopla, as well as you can buy it on Comixology and all the usual places that you find your comics. So with that all said, guys, the countdown begins. Happy reading, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Indie Comics Spotlight, a show where we spend time looking at an ongoing series of graphic novels from the company that we've been to. I hope here is that we do a deep dive on an indie comic you may have missed, give you a chance to talk about one of your favorites with us on social media afterwards. I'm your host, Tony Kramer of DC Comics News, Fantastic Universes. I've been reading comics since I was 12, and while I love a good superhero battle, I gravitate towards indie comics, the standalone graphic novels, because they give artists a chance to connect with readers in different ways and tell stories they may not have been able to tell with traditional comics or traditional novels. I hope that you enjoyed the show. Okay, well, today on Indie Comics Spotlight is a guy that I'm thrilled to meet, who I feel like I've gotten to know online. And if you don't follow him on Twitter, you will by the end of this. The amazing thing, before off air, we had talked for about 15, 20 minutes about how amazing the internet is and how it has brought us together to talk about this book. And so for those of you who've been listening, I have this new series called Hidden Gems, where I'm like just me by myself kind of riffing spoiler free on a book that I think people missed out on. And it was actually inspired by my guest, because I reached out to him a while ago and was like, hey, you should come on. What do you want to do? And he said, this book, which I hadn't even heard of. And so it is the ultimate hidden gem. And now I have it, and I'm so glad. So Chase, welcome to Indie Comic Spotlight, sir.
It's great to be here. I love it.
This is so exciting. I'm excited to have you here. You're a great follow. You're a great guy. You're positive, right? You're one of those guys who's like, I'm not going to take all the crap on Twitter. Like it's easy to hate, and you don't. So I always appreciate your tweets, because you're always something, like, you're something I love. You're never like, here's something stupid. I do that. I live in Florida, so unfortunately, sometimes I have to be like, my governor did something stupid. But for the most part, I try to.
Well, I'm in West Virginia, so if you're paying attention to politics right now, I'm right there with you.
Yeah, you get it. All right. Well, so the book we're going to do is from Bughouse. It's by Jason Pell and Blake Wheeler, and it is called Season's End, and it is gorgeous. But before we get into that and how you came to this, because you and the author know each other, so we'll end with that. That'll be our transition. So let's go back, way back, a young West Virginian named Chase. How is it that these fantastic things that we all love to talk about, comic books, came to you? For me, it was a Green Lantern on a spinner rack. What was it for you?
For me, it was a combination of my grandmother, who loves comic books. She has a shrine of Wonder Woman in her
house. Oh, she really?
Yeah, Wonder Woman she buys. So me and my brother also, anything Wonder Woman we buy for her. She has like Kingdom Come Wonder Woman. Like, she just has lunch boxes, everything.
Kingdom Come Wonder Woman and Alex, a life-size Alex Ross Kingdom Come Wonder Woman.
Yeah, like, this is big.
That's amazing.
And because of her, my father also liked comic books. And when we were younger, there was always sports cards, comic book store combinations, you know?
Sure. Yeah, I remember
We're in a very small town, so we had to drive into the city to go to them. So occasionally, when we did something good, Dad would drive us into the city, and we'd get to pick out whatever.
It was really for him. It was really about
him. Yeah. Especially when Image started, as we were there every week after Image started.
Suddenly, you guys were the greatest kids in the world. You guys were really good. Yeah, this
suddenly,
week.
I have a
got to get the Savage Dragon.
I had the whole brigade blood strike run where you had to get one after the other. For some reason, I was there. We get one or the other. He loves Savage Dragon. He still has a bunch of that.
That's still running.
So I grew up just with comic books, and then comic cards became a huge thing, and then X-Men animated series came on TV, and now people at school that didn't know about the X-Men are suddenly talking about it, and it just stayed from there. And then, as middle school does, you know, kind of dies off and stuff, but then high school was actually when I met Pell. And he was already out of high school, and his best friend, Willie, is what we call him, Jeremy Wilson, and Tim Grounds all owned and worked at a video store in my hometown. And it just became the hangout when we started talking, and they got me right back into comics that I'd missed for like 3 years. And I've never left.
That's awesome.
But I'd say if it had to be one thing, X-Men most likely is what really drug me into it, or just JSA.
I love some JSA stuff. Yeah, I think JSA doesn't get the love it deserves, because it's, you know, the thing about the JSA that is so cool is because they are older and more seasoned. They're not like, that's part of what makes the JSA story cool, is they're not invincible. You know,
and they aged them a bit, you know, as it goes. So you still have all like their wisdom. They're so iconic looking. And I mean, Wildcat to me is just one of the best characters.
He's my favorite JSA character.
Wildcat, Hourman, Starman. Those are probably my top. But obviously Jay Garrick, Alan Scott, you can't get rid of them. They're legendary status. But when you're reading the books, Team Book, I look for Wildcat. I look for Hourman. Like, I just love JSA.
Yeah, no, that's a great book. Yeah, I know. Wildcat was always great. I thought Hourman was such a cool power. What a cool idea that you have to be smart. Like, because he could only use his power for an hour at a time, he had to, like, most of the time when Our Man was doing stuff, he wasn't superpowered. He just had to be smart. It was such a clever idea. And I think some of those original Golden Age heroes really showed the brilliance of the writing. And while I love the modern day stuff, and, you know, Tim Drake is my favorite superhero. But the thing that I like,
Robin, so we're going to get...
Yeah,
awesome.
the thing that I like about Tim, that's why in that picture I showed you that Sam drew, I'm Tim. It's the Tim Drake. I've got the Tim Drake R on my arm. And the thing that I like about Tim is because, again, he's coming at it. He's the most human of the Robins. You know what I mean? He's not like Dick is light and funny and everything, but he still is weighed down by being the first. Where Tim, there's just something about him that is like, he is almost a Golden Age character.
Had a lot of loss that we went through with him. Like, there's a lot of depth there for the reader. Yeah. If you're reading him at that time.
So I get what you're saying about those old JSA comics. I was disappointed. Like, I was alive, you know, I bought the Crisis comics when they came out.
Yeah.
And so it always disappointed me that they did that, because I like the Earth 2 stuff, and I never found that confused. I actually have found the reboots and the reboots and the reboots of the modern time much more confusing, because it's too hard to keep up. It was almost just like, back then, I'm going to be grumpy old dad, back in my day, you could just like read the Batman comics, and the Batman comic and Detective comics weren't even connected. And the Green Lantern comic and the Flash comic, sometimes they bumped into each other because they were on the West Coast, but they didn't always. And so the universes were all really, you know, in their own bubbles. And then there would occasionally be the Justice League or the crossover books. And so it was easy to just keep, and then you had JSA where they were always their own thing. So it was easy to just kind of keep track, and All-Star Squadron. And then they did Infinity Incorporated, the kids of the JSA members. Mm-hmm. And so like you could follow along easily. And then when they eliminated all of that, I actually think it made it worse. And so now it's like, if you're trying to read this one comic, you have to have like 15 other comics to know what's going on. And that actually is more confusing than I can just keep the two universes straight.
I hate it when people are like, I'm going to start reading this. Where do I start? Like,
how do you know?
I know. You know, like, it's a rough one.
It is. It is. Yeah.
If there a thing like Invincible, start from the beginning. It's all there. But where are you going to tell someone to start at Spider-Man? You know?
Where would the clone, after the second clone saga? Right.
That'd be the starting point, it would have to be. Because you get rid of all that confusion.
Yeah.
But then...
Because if you try to explain the clone saga to someone, they're like, what now? What are you saying?
Like, well, it was really good for the first couple issues, or for the first half of the issues. And I was up for Ben Reilly, you know?
Yeah. Well, and so you're an X-Men person. So who's, like, Nightcrawler's my favorite Marvel character. Who's your favorite X-Man?
As far as X-Men, I mean, I always stick with Cyclops. I love Cyclops. Yeah. I have a... In my where I have all my comic stuff, I have like a little section of Cyclops stuff, like statues and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'm not ignorant to who he is.
Perceived. Yes.
He has done some messed up stuff, but just something about him, I hooked into him at the beginning. Colossus and Nightcrawler are also two huge ones.
Yeah.
But then I really like New Mutants characters and stuff like.
They were great. What a great book. It outsold X-Men for a while at the beginning. It was.
I love once you off. Sorry, once you go to all the off teams and everything, X-Factor, all like Peter David's X-Factor is great.
That was hysterical. Jamie, that was when Madrox was in there. That was great. Yeah,
I loved it. So I mean, it's hard for me to. I won't knock any X-Men. I love the X-Men, but Cyclops is definitely.
That's fair. Yeah. That's okay. It's funny because he's not, and I'm in the camp of like, I was always Team Storm, you know, like during the Who Will Lead Them.
Yeah.
But the Storm, I like Storm. She's right in the top five X-Men for me. Yeah. But there's a book Mike Corrado put out called Flamer, and it's about a young kid who's like coming out, and but he's an X-Men fan, and Jean is his hero. And so he's sitting at like this Boy Scout camp, and he's talking about how Phoenix is great, and somebody else is saying how, like Wolverine is great, and somebody else sits down and is like, and these kids are like fighting like comic nerds do, and somebody sits down and goes, I like Cyclops, and they both just turn and scream shut up at him, because it's like they can agree that they hate Cyclops together. So it's just pretty funny, especially as a Jean
Grey.
A
lot of questionable things,
right? I mean, yeah, well, and married had sex with a clone and had a baby, and there's a whole, like, we don't have time to get into that here,
because you know, like
yeah. But the X-Men, that's why I think the X-Men work, though. And again, like the JSA, they're just more seasoned. They feel more real. Like, I think that's what it is about Dick Grayson and Tim Drake for me, is they're just, and Babs, they've got a much more real personality to them. Mm-hmm. Whereas Bruce, I love Batman. I've got my Batman mug here. Batman's my guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he's so hard to like. You know, he's kind of a dick. Yeah. And so I think the night with, there's a lot of that in X, where X-Men deal with that. Like, if you look at it on paper, Charles Xavier's kind of creepy.
Yeah. He's,
you know,
so he's a villain.
Right. In a different, right. And if the book were told from Magneto's perspective, Charles is the villain. And so I think that's what the X-Men does, is it humanizes them in a real way. And like the little things, like Kitty wearing her Star of David. It's not like a big deal, but you acknowledge she's a person of faith and she's this thing, and the way that Peter is with Kitty and with his sister, and like that way his heart breaks is real, even though he's this big guy, he's like such a soft heart. So I think the X-Men do such a great job of humanizing characters, and it's why we live in these fantasy worlds, because these people are real to us, right?
Right. Yes. I will defend some of these fake people more than I would defend some of the real people.
I totally agree. Yeah. Hanging out with fake people. It's like me and my wife and a bunch of fake people. Like, we always say we have the world's smallest book club. So like, we each read a ton of books, but about half of them we read the same. So about 100 books a year, we both read. And so it'll be like, we'll just sit at dinner. And one of our daughters once said, you guys, because we were just like at dinner one day, they're like, she hadn't read the book yet. We're like, I don't know, sorry, we're going to talk about it. So she's like, it's like you're the world's smallest book club. And we still do that. We're like constantly reading the same stuff. And, you know, and so I like her, and then, you know, fictional people. And
so, yeah. Me and my wife both read, but she does not read the same things I do. Like, we're completely different in terms of
reading. That's okay.
But oh, yeah, it's fine.
Because your kids seeing your kids are seeing lots of options, and that's all that matters, right? Is they're seeing
my 7-year-old already has me buying him comic books. He learned how to read, and I'll give the full credit to Judd Winnick for the Hilo series. He loves the Hilo series, and I've been a fan of Judd for
ever.
I mean, obviously, Real World and stuff, but his Green Arrow, like he
Red Hood.
Exiles is Jason. One of my favorite.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, Red Hood in general. He has one of the first people that I spoke to on Twitter, not as a comic, yeah, as Chase Black, was to tell him how much my son loved his Hilo series. And it's how he, some sections have just onomatopoeias. And that's how he started saying the odds and stuff like that. And now he, hey, there's a new Hilo book coming out. Like, so we had to get him. And now he's gone through. I've got Challenge of the Super Sons. He gets now. We just got Reptile number one in because he loves dinosaurs. Nice. And he used to watch the Superhero Squad show. So he knows Reptile and he wanted to read about him. So we have, it's starting for him.
That's awesome. That's great. Yeah, no, I mean, and so I grew up in books, but then when I discovered comics, it was just like another thing. And what you've chosen for us is literature, is a book that, with it just happens to have some drawing, amazing art in it. So it's such a cool idea.
The definition of a graphic novel.
It is the original graphic novel. Correct.
Like,
yeah, it's deceptive. It's
a novel with graphics.
Yeah. So you knew Pell. He's from West Virginia.
Right. He's he went to my high school.
Okay. So he's a little bit older than you. Okay.
Right. I say when we met, I think I was probably 16 or 17. And he was 24 or 25, something like that. Cool. You know,
yeah, nice.
They're working at the video store, him and Willie and our other friend Tim Grounds. And as a kid who just liked movies and comics, just started chatting, and next thing I knew, that's where I was hanging out. And next thing I knew, all my friends were hanging out there too, and they were like, hey, we go to these trips to Chicago every year. And suddenly we all became a group, and we did it for years together.
Hell, that's
started
awesome.
Writing comics, we started helping them promote them.
And now here we are talking about it.
And here we are. And I always said, this is actually my first podcast.
Well, welcome.
And I always said that if someone asked me to do one, I really want to do one of his books, because other than the fact that I know him and he's my friend, I really enjoy his writing.
Oh.
And I enjoy his art too. He didn't do this, but
this one.
Yeah, Blake Wheeler, who's also from West Virginia, did this one. But he does all the art for his Pinpricks books.
Yeah, yeah.
And every once in a while, other things. Some covers for Zombie Highway he did and stuff like that. And I love his art as well. He's just very talented.
Yeah. And I like that he totally DIY'd it. You know, I mean, and, you know, it's not as though he,
you know, Marvel, is his.
Right. If Marvel came knocking, I don't think he'd say no. But I also appreciate that he's like, well, not only do I want to do my own comics, he started his own company. And then he brings in people who kind of have the same, you know, kind of DIY adventure spirit that he has. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that. I appreciate the people who just are like, I'm going to do a thing I love and let's hope people like it. And mine is hardbound and gorgeous.
Yes. I want to say the letterer on this is Jason Arthur, who's also from, I don't know if you remember Digital Webbing. He's back from the Digital Webbing days.
Oh.
Is where Jason Arthur came from. Pell met him doing his original comics, like when we first started Bug House, and he's still, you know, they're DIY in it.
That's awesome.
Made the connections, and they still.
He's awesome. I was going to talk about him as a letterer because he's had a lot to do. And it looks like he did it by hand. And if he didn't, you know, if he typed it, it still was very well placed and well done. So,
credited as a lettering artist or something.
Lettering director. Yes. So here's the plot of, we're going to go pretty much spoiler free here for the next little while, because what we want is people to go get this book. It came out in 2003 and it came out from Bug House Comics, which is a company that Pell owns himself, and Suicide 5, Seasons End, Zombie Highway are all on there. And he's got a few other guys. And so this is a one shot, which could end up being, if he wanted to revisit this world, there's plenty there. But it's been 8 years. So maybe at the 10th year anniversary, we'll get a sequel, maybe. And if we don't, I'm also okay with that. So we're not going to spoil too much. So for everybody to know, it is a self-contained story with the potential for more. And I think any good story does that. Any good story ends, and then it allows you an opportunity as a reader or as a viewer, if you're watching a film or watching a play, to figure out, to think about what happens next and let those characters live on, unless it's a Shakespearean tragedy and everybody's dead. But for the most part, you're going to have a few survivors. And so you can think about what happens next. And I think he does a great job here. So since you picked this, tell everybody, give us just a brief synopsis of what this is, and then we'll get into it. I've got some questions about what he's doing, and we'll have to talk about Blake's stunning art. So give everybody just a brief rundown, if you will, sir.
All right. So Season's End is a fantasy book. It's Pell's foray into fantasy. It's about a world called Tin Wars, and it is coming to its last season, where the world's getting covered in darkness and magic has gone shifty. There's a dark lingering presence in magic when it's used, and there is some towns that are completely being taken over by this dark magic, and there is a group of people on their way to stop it. I mean, I guess without giving too much away, I want to be as vague as I can.
It's a
hero's quest. Yeah, they pick up some travelers along the way. They make friends. They make enemies. And
they make frenemies.
And some really creepy aspects happen in this book, which is very Pell. He likes the macabre. He likes creepy. And there are some certain creatures in this book that when I first read it, I was like, how'd you even think of these, the sounds that it says they make as they're the, I'm talking, I don't want to give away what I'm talking about, but I'm sure you know.
Like, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, yeah.
And it's a lot deeper of a story than you expect it to be. When you start talking about Grib, when you start talking about
Grib's a fascinating character.
Yeah. I love the character Grib. The monks at the beginning, the way the other characters feel about Grib, like Dunlari is just such a silent badass and you just don't know what to make of him throughout most of the story. And you
Adriel's my favorite.
Adriel is probably the strongest character in the whole.
Yeah, I thought that was really smart. So the main, I would say, like, these are our three. I mean, we're focusing on these characters, and so there's Adriel, who is like this warrior badass. Like, she is, I mean, this is written post Buffy, so clearly there's a little bit of Buffy in there, but there's a lot of
Pell loves Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Like, that was he's the one who got me watching it back in the early 2000s.
Nice. Okay.
And because of him, he ruined a big part of it, but it wasn't his fault, just a signed autograph picture I saw at his house.
Oh no, fair.
And I was like, and then I was waiting for it the entire series to happen. Like, it's gonna be this time. It's gonna be this time.
But,
well, but I think that was very Buffy. I think the idea of Adriel was very Buffy centric.
Yeah, so
and I think being the best.
Right. And I think what I like about her too is that it's not, I think it's really smart that he's got this female character who is just kind of one of the guys. It's not, it's acknowledged she's a she. She has she pronouns. She's clearly drawn as a woman. She's a woman, but she's not anybody's object. And I think that was the thing that stood out to me the most. And that was one of the questions I wanted to have for you is, like, especially growing up with your grandma being a Wonder Woman fan, knowing that now, that changes this question I'm going to ask you. This is like the first thing I was like, okay, I got to ask about Adriel. Is and because Wonder Woman, of course, is a badass in her own right. And so there's a lot of Wonder Woman in Buffy. There's a lot of Wonder Woman in Adriel. But she's still objectified in so many ways, especially the way that Wonder Woman is dressed. But that isn't the case here with Adriel. And I thought it was not so refreshing that there's this strong female character who, being female, is just on a list of character traits. It's not the thing. At no point are we worried for her. There's no, my concern always, as soon as I met Adriel, I'll be honest, when I first met her, my concern with fantasy books is always, it's easy to fall into this, like, really gross misogynistic thing happens in fantasy books and women become commodities in science fiction and fantasy. And it's gross. And I'm sure that's Margaret Atwood does it. I mean, it's not like it's just like men do it. Women do it too. And it's it's a reality, air quotes, of things, but
it's an easy trope to fall into.
And he didn't. So what did you make of that? And it was really noticeable to me right away, but, you know, you growing up as a nerd too, and having Wonder Woman as a hero, you probably caught on what he was doing. What did you make of that? And do you think you know him, so maybe you can just answer. Is that an intentional move to just subvert
that? I honestly believe it was an intentional move. Knowing this Pell personally and stuff, that falls right in line with, I mean, I don't want to go into his personal life or anything, but he has very strong women in his life and stuff. And on top of that, I had spoken before we started recording about the Dragonlance series. And yeah, the Dragonlance series is filled with very strong women, warrior women, cleric women. Some of the strongest characters in the books are women, and they don't become objects of the other characters' desires. They are their own characters, and they hold, you know, their presence very well. And I think he takes a lot from, just because I've read so much Dragonlance as well, and I know he's such a big fan, I see it in some of his characters. And there's character Christiana, who is very, she reminds me of a lot. But when I first started reading it, I thought there was going to be a whole thing with her and Mimdil, who she's supposed to be protecting.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And
when we first meet her, that's what she's doing.
Right. Yeah, correct.
Here comes this red Sonya looking badass. Yeah.
Right. And she was sleeping.
It's amazing. I know.
I think it's very on the nose. I think he purposely, and I think purposely didn't have a love interest at all in it.
I loved it.
And that's great. And I love that. And actually, that's something my grandmother loves about certain fantasy movies. She hates love interest in movies. She'll be like, she went and saw Lord of the Rings before I got to see Lord of the Rings. She went on opening day. She rode her bike to the theater and saw it. Handed me my brother and was like, you got to come see this movie. Made us drive her back to the theater. And she was like,
she can watch it great. Again.
Yeah, she's like, it's great. There's hardly any of the gooey love stuff that they don't like shove it in your face. She's like, you'll love it. Like all of her movie interest will base on if there's too much gooey love stuff. She doesn't want to.
So she believes in the Bechdel test all the way. Nice. That's awesome. That's amazing. I love her as a character. I think that's so great. I think there's a little bit of Red Sonja too, obviously, in how she's drawn. I'm assuming that was Wheeler's choice was to, and again, we were talking off air about Gail Simone.
Right.
The queen. I don't know if you've read her run on Red Sonja is practically perfect. And
no, I haven't. Actually, I haven't read much Red Sonja in general.
It's up and down, but her run, it's 18 issues. It was for Dynamite. And the thing that I like about it is she does sexualize Red Sonja, but she's in control of it at all times because she's fucking Red Sonja. She's not, there's no coercing Red Sonja to do anything. So she's bisexual. And so whatever strikes her fancy, whomever and whatever strikes her fancy, Red Sonja gets. And so it's, but you know, a lot of times, and she smells bad because she's like this warrior wearing like wolf skin. So there's a lot of comments like, you need to take a bath. So they draw her in this way. So I really love that like real grittiness. And I feel like there's a lot of that here too. And again, these characters stand on their own, but I'm just trying to get an idea for people to be like, oh, I like that Red Sonja. Oh, I would like this. Oh, I like Lord of the Rings. Oh, I would like this. So I want people to know, I like Buffy or Wonder Woman. I think you would love Adriel. I think she's a great role model character for men and women, boys and girls. I think she's, I mean, this isn't for little kids. I wouldn't give this to anybody younger than 15 or 16.
Right. Oh,
but,
yeah.
But she's a pretty awesome. She's an aspirational character.
I completely agree.
Yeah. So let's talk about the rest again, because I think we can just talk a little bit about the characters a little bit without spoiling too much. So we've got Mimdil, you've got Dunlari, you've got Grib. Grib is really fascinating. Who's your
one of the best characters? Grib and you already said Adriel. Grib and Adriel are probably my favorite characters. Grib is just, you don't know what he is. You don't know why he's there. You don't know his, you feel terrible for him. You know that much, but you don't know his intentions because he just, like when he is let loose, he just starts blacksmithing and taking care of the person who's enslaving him. So it's a very, you don't understand the relationship. You don't understand why he's here, but you feel sorry for him.
Yeah. And I think it's a really cool, again, character design. Grib is this little blue,
what's his race? He's a trollish character, but
he's a troll type. Yeah, he's tiny. He's on a chain at all times. He's got big ears and two big fangs that stick out of his mouth there. Yeah. He's really fascinating because It almost, he feels a little monk. I know there's another monk in here, but I always feel like Grib feels more like a monk than the monk.
Yeah. Yes.
Is that too much of a reach? You said yes. So we're just going to go with yes. That's the fact.
Yeah. I was trying to process how to also comment on it, but no, I agree. He's very, he keeps to himself. You don't know what he's thinking. He's calculated in what he's doing. And you don't realize that. And then you get the backstory on him and it's just, he's, other than, literally, he probably has a big swing of a story arc that you weren't expecting.
You weren't expecting at all. And I thought that was good. This is one of those ones is when you're done, you need to read it again immediately after.
Right.
I know they're not related at all, but did you see the movie Parasite?
Yes.
South Korean movie? Yes. As soon as that was over, I had to watch it again.
See from a different perspective as well.
Right. So like, oh shit. Okay. And that's what I felt like with this, when you get to the reveals. And again, this is not spoilery. This is going to tease people to go buy it. When you get to the end of this book, you immediately need to go back to the beginning and go like, oh, that's where that clue was. Because what I love about Pell's writing in this is nothing is wasted. And so the way everybody, let me explain this to everybody. So it's like, as Chase said, it's a novel. It's an old school graphic novel. So it's set up with no word balloons. So it's full page splashes. Almost every page that's in color is a full page splash with the words in white written over the picture, like directly on the picture. And then
I would say to help out, maybe if anybody's been getting any of those, the graphic Harry Potter tabletop books.
Oh, I've not been seen coming those. Out, oh.
It's the exact same thing. Every page is a painted picture with the novel on top of it. Like,
nice.
Very, very similar to this style. And
so she owes him some money, is what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying.
Mike Pelichek. She's got plenty of money. She can send one to West Virginia.
She's probably writing a lot of checks right now anyway. So just
for sure. Name on. Yeah, that's true. But, and so then on the other pages, the more like, it's not even black and white. It's more like cream and black. There'll be just like a sketch of a close-up of a hand or a face or something. And then it just reads like a regular novel where it's not a splash page. So, but again, even those little black and white, this is my favorite one.
Yeah.
What a drawing. There's this drawing of this scarecrow guy. He reminds me of, did you ever read the Giver series?
No, I did not.
There's a character in the second one of the Giver series who's like who's the bad guy. And I was like, that was the picture I had in my head of the Trade Master. It was like the trademark guy was this. I was like, oh, that's just this creepy and the grin on his face. So it's real great work by Blake. And so
he mentioned that grin too, that he's always grinning in any situation. You don't understand it. Like they mentioned that later on, Adriel notices it. That no matter what's happening, he's always smiling.
But he's not smiling. It's like a grin. It's a teeth. Mouth open, teeth closed, grin. And that is scary. Everybody thinks about that. If you see somebody who's got his teeth clenched together and he's smiling, you're going to be unnerved. You either think that's a fake smile or you're about to eat me. One of those two things. And there's and a lot.
You said he doesn't waste anything. It reminds me, and that goes to, I think, where he really likes Neil Gaiman. And Neil Gaiman wastes nothing. And I think Pell puts a lot of thought into his stories before he writes it down, or I think he'll even come up with something and be like, oh, I need to go back there and intertwine this in, because all of his stories, if you read them, they flow so well. Like, it seems like there's a lot of thought process behind the writing of them.
Yeah, and it is interesting that he chose to do this. I'm glad he did it as a graphic novel because it's gorgeous, but it's interesting that that was his choice, because you didn't be like
pictures like this one.
Oh, this, yeah, that's right on the back too. That's a full splash page of somebody being dragged and the fingers are scratching into the dirt, and the look of terror on the face is stunning.
I want to feel like what Pell thought whenever Philip sent that to him for the first time.
Yeah. Well, and so do you know, how did that work? Since we keep touching on the art, let's talk about the art before we talk some of the other themes. So Blake Wheeler, these are paint.
Oh, sorry, Blake, I said Philip. Blake,
Yeah. Blake Wheeler, these are paintings. And again, Neil Gaiman, obviously all the covers of the Neil books, but were all paintings. So there's a lot of Sandman-y things going on. So what was the process? Because they created this together. So do you know what the process was? Was it, did Blake read the script and then pick out one picture, or did he just do whatever pictures he wanted and then Blake adjusted the script to it?
I feel like I should know the answer to this.
That's okay if you don't.
I helped sell the book at a convention with Blake. and I've met him and everything. But I do not know. I know that Pell would just go to places like Digital Webbing or other areas and find artists and people he'd like to collaborate with. I know that I'm pretty sure the guy who did Grell when it first was in Argentina, you know, just, and it was all emailed to him like back and forth. But since Blake's also from West Virginia, I feel like they might probably met up somewhere else and started collaborating. I really don't know. I wish I did.
Yeah, no, it's fair. I don't think it matters either way, because what you have are these.
They still created something great. And I want to think that Blake had some of the design, like, right. Like he had the ability to design some of himself.
Because he's co-creator. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. And just the way they look doesn't seem like that was something like it has to. It looked like he came, like this was a thought process when he made them. Like, because some, I can find the one picture. Sorry, just babbling. The one where literally. I'm sorry. A lot of.
No, it's all right.
Like,
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like just the scarf swirling and the rapier going through, like just that whole image just to me screams that like he had the thought of having the scarf on the character. He had this whole flow.
Yeah, because you set the scarf up earlier and it's all wound tight around him. And right. Then it comes undone. So it's like it becomes its own character. Because when you first see the scarf too, he's in black and white and you don't understand what it is too much. And right. Then when you see him in color, let's talk about the color because Blake does the colors too. I the color palette in here is fascinating. And I know
grim.
It is. And it was such a, and it's a dark book. The subject matter is dark. And yet, so he draws these blues and blacks, but there's a lot of orange. And I'm not, my colors palette in my eyes, I'm slightly colorblind, not terribly, but slightly. So I know I'm sure I'm missing some subtle details that probably ruins the experience, but what do you make of the tone that it said? I always say the colorist, and it was Blake who did it himself, is like the person who writes a score for a movie.
Yeah.
And it really sets a tone here. What do you make of that? And again, because sometimes you go from a full color page to like a black and white page, and then back, like all of a sudden you're dropped in this big splashy color page that's like full of fire and literal fire and brimstone in some cases.
Literal fire and brimstone, yeah. I like that. Depending on the area they're at, it seemed like that was the wash of it. Like at the very beginning, when they're camping at the monks, it's all blue toned, you know. And then as they are start traveling and they start picking up and it's getting good, it's very lightly,
right?
Like it's like yellow tones. But then once you start getting to Dwyn Mawr, it's all red tones, and it's just other than the words themselves, like the colors of the book just give you the whole feel of what's happening here. Like, you know, to be a little bit bright and upbeat when they have the light areas, the very few light areas you have, you know, but then once you turn the page and it's back to those dull tones, you know that something grim's about to happen here.
And I appreciated those light moments because it like a story like this, it's only 120 pages, but you don't want it to be exhausting the whole time. Like, you don't want it to be like everything is the worst thing ever. Even
right,
no matter what it is. I mean, the reason that Pippin, we talked about the Lord of the Rings, the reason Pippin and Merry are in that book and in the movie is because you need the love. Could you imagine that book without Pippin and Merry? What would that be? It would be awful. It would be so exhausting without them.
Right.
You know, comic relief matters. Shakespeare has comic relief. Chaucer had comic relief. And not that there's comic relief, but there's a lightness. We need a minute to breathe. We need a halftime. And because he's publishing this as a graphic novel instead of individual books, it was so well paced. It was smart to be like, all right, here's a moment. We're going to give them a reprieve. They're going to hang out. They're going to eat. We're going to treat them as real people. It was good storytelling visually. And obviously the script itself needed that. We as the reader needed a break because this book compels you to read it in one sitting. And I don't think that you can. And I did. I have. Several times, but I don't know that I could have if it weren't for those breaks.
Right. And that is one thing that Pell brings to all of his writing. He has a lot of levity. Like, and he writes some grim things, but even his Pinprick series, which is kind of like train of thought. Every page is a different story. It's one page stories of different characters. And some of them are crazy dark, but then other ones are just very, very lighthearted. And the placement of them in the book just makes it flow so well. Another thing he's good at is pacing. And like said, the pace in this book was good. And I said previously that I think it was paced so well that it seems like a condensed version of a larger book. Like, you get the whole story in it. It's paced completely, but it just seems like there's areas that you could really fill those out for more of the adventure and more of the tales, that I could see it being a novel. Like whenever they did the comic version of the Dark Tower, you know, it was a very condensed version of what you got, but it made sense. It was paced well. You got the story.
It actually fixes some of the problems with the Dark Tower.
Yes. Yes, it does. And I'm a man that who loves Stephen King.
That was him at his wordiest. I'm that and Under the Dome. I couldn't finish Under the Dome, to be fair. I didn't finish, I'll be honest, I didn't finish the after Wizards and Glass. I was like, I'm done. I didn't finish the Dark Tower because it was that was like a 10-year gap. And then it was so long, and I felt like I read the one that came right after Wolves, and then I didn't. Yeah, I didn't read the last two. I know that I will one day, but I have seen those graphic novels, and I was like, I like what I only read the ones that I read. You know, I didn't read.
Yeah,
but
Wizards and Glass was probably my favorite.
Oh, is that right?
I love Wizards.
It's worth going back. Yeah, I mean, and, it's such a
Song
cool
of Susanna,
story.
Song of Susanna that comes next after Wolves of Call, I believe, is much more condensed. It's a lot smaller book, but it answers almost every question before the last book.
So I gave up too quickly. Yeah, he is, same with Under the Dome. Like, there's very few books where you can say, I gave up after 400 pages and nothing had happened. But that's what that was. I read an entire novel, which was just the first 25% of Under the Dome. And I was like, I am tapping out. I don't like any of these people. I don't care. I hope they all suffocate in there.
I feel nothing for these characters.
I feel nothing for them. But it's
interesting. Then there's Misery, where I was hooked in the first four pages. You're like,
I read that in one sitting. I didn't do anything that day. I started that in the morning and I didn't stop until night. And I was like, my leg was shaking with the with the electric knife.
The house and you just coming back, like I was sweating. Yeah. Like I had to let go of the pages because I was like ruining
it. It's so good. But you're right, seeing that's what he does. He that was one of my other questions. So that's a good transition. Is there's a lot of horror elements to his fantasy here. Not all fantasy has is horror. Sometimes fantasy is just fantasy. And it's just like, there's a wizard and there's a dragon. And that inherently could be scary. Like there's no horror. We'll keep using the ultimate fantasy novel, The Lord of the Rings, other than maybe the spiders. There's not a ton of, and if you're not a scared of spiders, you don't care. So there's not a ton of horror in there, right? There's adventure and there's life and death moments, but it's not horrific. There's some horrific events in here. And so what do you make of that? And is that part of what makes the pacing work, is because he scares us too. And as we were just talking with Stephen King, good horror is well-paced and bad horror isn't well-paced.
Correct. And he hits you with the horror moments in this book. And some of them are just so creepy, you want it to be over. So you're just reading faster to get out of it. And then it starts picking up levity again. You're like, all right, you're going, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I gotta get out of this moment again.
I think that's well said. It's like you're on the hills,
right?
The way you're describing it is it's the rolling hills of West Virginia,
exactly. Even in Zombie Highway, which is based in the rolling hills of West Virginia, it's more of a comedy horror. It's like a buddy comedy with horror elements. So most of his work has to deal with horror and comedy. I think he did the American Mythologies. He did Zorro for them, and it was Zorro and the old gods, like Cthulhu and stuff. So he, once again, very Pell, mixed horror and comedy together. And it's depends. It's always more horror or more comedy, you know? But he does it well. That's a very good niche that he has.
Like. Yeah, and I think that's why I liked it. Because again, like I said, I don't love a ton of fantasy. I'm more of a science fiction guy than a fantasy guy. In general, writ large, I prefer science fiction to fantasy. And I hear what you're saying, how this feels like a condensed version of a longer book, but I think that is also why it works, is because if this were a novel, and which, as I said, I'm surprised he decided to write it as a graphic novel, but now I've talked myself to the other side of the conversation, is that because he made it a graphic novel, he doesn't have to, he again, just like with Adriel and just like with Grib, he can subverse, he can flip the way we see things, and he can subvert tropes. And so if this were a novel, there would have to be those long plotting things, which I don't mind in some books, but in some books you're like, all right, I don't need the description of this blade of grass. Let's move on.
Well, when you're saying that Lord of the Rings didn't have big horror elements, and I'm thinking, well, there's the Witch King of Angmar and all that. But by the time you get done reading the description of the Witch King of Angmar, your fear's gone.
Right.
It's like, okay, here's this guy. That family's very wet.
Everything's fine. Yeah. Yeah, but I think by him making it a graphic novel, he gives, because there's very few things, it's so weird, because there's very few things that Wheeler draws that Pell hasn't written, but the story doesn't work without the art, because it does, you could read it without the art and get a sense of the story, or read it without the words, just as a picture book, and get a real good sense of what's happening, and you could see the arc and the journey because of the colors, as we talked about, and the way you described it so perfectly, that it's like, in this scene it's blue, in this scene it's light, in this scene it's, so you know what's happening. But so he tells a visual story, the words obviously enhance that story, but it is a really almost like a masterclass on how to cut the fat. You know, Faulkner said, kill your darlings. Well, he did. Mm-hmm. He could have written a 600-page fantasy novel, but he was like, I've got a 120-page graphic novel that does the same thing that a 600-page fantasy novel does, without all the creepy, leery, busty wench nonsense that has to show up in most of these books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he...
I'd like to try that, Adriel.
Yeah, right. Cover that. It's just efficient. It's an efficient story that I think is, again, I'm very impressed by. To me, the thing I think he could fill in, I'd be interested in, like companion pieces to young Adriel's story, like these people, like prequels to these, those are the things that, again, I think a fantasy novel, that's how he would have filled it in, by being back when Adriel was 7, here's what happened. We don't have to do that, because it's less relevant to this story.
You know, there's he could have written more of their travels, you know, but instead of like 2 nights and they already found Gwynmar, you know, and you're like, and it paced right to it. And you didn't need all that extra added description and stuff that a lot of people could have put in there, just wanting to beef it up instead of sticking straight to the story.
Yeah.
And like I said, he paced it well. I think it all worked out very well.
Oh, yeah. Right.
We haven't talked about what's the robot guy? The guy with the iron. Dalimor? No, not Dalimor. That's
Falarin. I can't say.
Oh, we haven't talked about him either, have we?
And Dinlari.
Dinlari, when you read his description and see the picture, should be the most interesting character to you, and somehow he's not. Like, somehow you're more interested in the monk cleric, or in Adriel, or even
in another story, Dunlari is the hero.
In another story, a half metal man is going to get 80% of the attention,
and but he's not. Yeah,
he's not, and that's partially to the character himself. He's quiet. He keeps himself. He just wants to do the mission, and even in that, he has character development by the end.
Yeah, like, it's really smart. Well, I think it's because. When you read, you're like, there's a cleric, there's this little ogre thing, there's a woman, oh, there's this metal guy, who's the hero?
Right.
Like, on paper, who's the hero? Ah, he's one of the team. He's not the hero. He's not.
There's a metal guy with a slave ogre thing attached to him. Like,
every
part of this character is like, this is the character.
Yeah.
But he's pretty much a Mimdal story, if anybody would be a character.
Oh, it's Mimdal's story.
Yeah.
I think, oh, I mean, in Adriel, it's almost like his Girl Friday kind of situation,
right,
you know.
Yeah.
But again, and I like that, you know, she's the bodyguard, she's the one. No, it is. It's Mimdal's the hero's journey, the Luke Skywalker character,
Frodo. There's not a hint of romance between the two of them.
Love it.
Just
say how impressed I was. I kept waiting for that shoe to drop, and I was like, oh, by halfway, I realized he wasn't going to do it. And I was like, good. Mm-hmm. That was so awesome. Because you didn't
and then
need
we
it.
Can talk Right. He didn't. It was not needed. In fact, it would have kind of ruined it, I think.
Oh, it would have. And I'm sure he knew that. I'm sure he knew from the beginning. Yeah.
Because it takes away from her character.
Like, right. She doesn't. That's not her.
Lusted over. She would lust over somebody.
Like, I think there'd be lots of people banging into the people in front of them as they all turned and looked at her and she walked by. But she's not interested. She's got her own.
Her mission, her goal.
And she's a warrior. Well, let's talk about the God stuff. We can't avoid the religion conversation, can we?
Right, yes.
So that was the big thing. So I wanted to talk about my big two questions were Adriel and the religion thing. And I loved the rest of it. This is just so fun. Thank you. The beauty of this show is that we can talk for an hour and then we're all done. You're like, boy, did we even cover anything that's on our notes? No, it didn't matter. Like I've learned.
In my head, I'm telling myself over and over again, like, you're just babbling, man.
I know, it's perfect. The thing is for me, when I first started doing the show, like I was like 20 pages of notes, you know, on everything. And now I'm like, I realize I get to two of those things. For me, it's just a conversation. It's just about fun. It's about nerds nerding out and talking about this fun, dorky stuff so that we get other people who care. So if we just have a chat and it's less robotic, even when I interview people, like this is pretty cool. I'm pretty excited. In a week and a half, I'm interviewing Tom Pear. Ahoy Comics, Tom Pear.
Oh, yeah.
And I've got like two questions. My hope is that will just be the conversation I've got. Mostly I want to talk about Penultiman because I loved that book. Did you read that book?
No, I did not.
And then the Other Earth he does too. The one where
and Other Earth is one that I have not read yet, but Peter Smart, who we've been before, talking to me about it all the time. And actually I had a message to him the other day about should I find this book? And he was like, because someone had offered me the single issues, but they were moderately expensive what they were asking. And he was like, just find it in trade, man. Just read it.
Get the trade though. The point is I just love to chat. So I'm okay. So the second big question for me is the religion stuff. I love a book that has a conversation without having a conversation.
I always feel like you need to read Dragonlance.
Yeah, I'm gonna want Dragonlance on the list. The ever-growing list, as Jack and I say. We send each other stuff. Jack, my co-host of the season's greeting show, we're always like, he even does the thing where it's Captain America saying it's on the list. And he just, that's the thing. So I, as someone who was raised, born and raised Catholic, no longer plays for that team. Because I feel like with Catholics, you're either a Catholic, like Stephen Colbert is a Catholic and he's a Sunday school teacher and, you know, Catholic, or you're like, and you kind of get it. That's me. I'm the second kind of lapsed, fallen, whatever you want to say, Catholic.
What do you want to say about it?
So I just want to preface that. I'm not trying to, I work for Catholic nuns. My university is run by Dominican sisters. So I'm not anti-religion in any way, but I love a conversation about religion and the way that to me, and this is what I'd like to hear from you, and feel free to share your religious views or not. There's no pressure there. But to me, Pell is asking us to have a conversation about, is it religion that's bad or is it the people who practice the religion that's bad?
Right.
That is what's happening in this book. And he makes me think thoughts about that. And I love it for that purpose. Do you agree? Do you disagree? What do you think?
I completely agree. I always felt me and Pell have a very similar take on religion, the way that pretty much me and most of my friends feel about religion, which is I have no problem with it. You know, if you want to practice religion, if that's what helps you get through this life, and if that's what you need, then more power to you. I have no problem with your religion, but I'm not, also don't take part in your religion. I understand it and I respect every aspect of it for you, but I'm not a part of it. And that stands for every single religion out there. You know, I respect your religion. I respect your feelings, your beliefs, whatever helps you, but I don't need that. Like, it's just not a part of me. And, I hope I don't offend anybody with that. That's just
no. I did a whole show on Mark Russell's Second Coming on here, so don't worry.
I can also tell you, I will be probably the most polite and nicest person you ever that you'll meet, because I believe in treating people right and all that, but I just don't need a religion to tell me how to do that. Like, also, I don't believe that you need to be a practicing part of a church or religion to feel that faith and to be a part of it yourself. And, you know, so
I agree.
I live in West Virginia. There's a church on every corner, you know, so.
There is. I've been to West Virginia. It's a fact. It's a fact. You can't. You drive in, it says almost heaven, West Virginia, because all the churches are here. That's right? Why. Yeah. It doesn't say that second part, but it might as well.
So I've navigated it my whole life and I have no problem with it.
Yeah.
I went to church until I was a senior in high school. You know, I've been in it. But only Methodist and Baptist. So that's my extent of religious knowledge. And I understand, you know, where they're coming from and all that. And there's stuff I learned from doing school, like for doing daycare, like school stuff at church. Like,
Sunday school.
Still good.
Yeah.
Sunday school. Thank you. I don't know. They instill good aspects into
you. Of course. Yeah.
But I just don't need the. I'm not going to blindingly follow something, I guess is my thing. But onto the story, you get your first hint of it whenever Mimdal sees this monk that he's known for years suddenly act different, the thought of him getting taken away. Like at the very beginning of the book, it's the doubt of it all starts creeping in as to who are the real, like what's the real bad thing here. And by the end of it, you're kind of still questioning.
You are, because there's that awesome prequel. There's the whole
at the very preface. Very end of it.
Yeah. The whole preface at the beginning of like explaining the religion of this world, and you're like, well, this is, I see where you're going here. This looks, you're pretending like because he gives it weird names, it's easy to be like, that's weird. I've never, right. But then you're like, oh, he's just saying this is a thing. Like we all understand this because it's doesn't matter what vocabulary you give it, the feeling, the way that it's being used is exactly the same as every religion on earth.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I guess maybe that crept into my mind because I kind of is what I was saying too. Yeah, but
no, I think that's what I agree with what you're saying because of that, because it's all there. He's setting you up, and then you're like, huh?
You come to it, the conclusion with Mimdal as it goes there, what he's getting at, and the whole aspect of all the old gods are dying and the new gods are darker, you know. And the people that are given the faith believe in these darker new gods. So they got all the power. They got the strength. So they're bringing up all these things that weren't on our earth, like that were living underneath and stuff like that, because they believe in these old gods. And now they have all the power.
Right.
And the good gods of light have died out. And now that's the world.
That's the thing is that's what I'm getting at. And because it doesn't even have to be for people who don't want it to be religion. It could be politics. It could be whatever. Power is the thing. So it's what are the things we have to do? I mean, you just described, I'm much older than you. So my president, like the president, I was born when Nixon was still president and I remember Ford, but my president growing up was Jimmy Carter. He's he's the president I remember the most. He's the president I still to this day love the most. Like as a human being, he's awesome. Like when Jimmy Carter dies, I'm gonna be really upset. I know he's like 97.
Helping build a house.
Yeah.
Building houses last year. Like,
with a brain tumor, he's something. But I grew up with remembering this transition between Ford and Carter. And like, that was pretty easy, right? I mean, Ford and Carter are essentially the same old, nice man and who like genuinely have that what's best for the country in mind. Neither of them could lead their own parties today, right? For whatever reason. But like Gerald Ford was a Republican. There's no way the Republicans, this version of the Republican Party, would even understand who Gerald Ford is. Like he couldn't be in this party. Jimmy Carter is pretty liberal. Maybe he could be in the modern day Democratic Party, but I'm not sure. And so that's what you're just saying is you keep like the and it's not necessarily a call to the old ways were better, but maybe the old ways were more pure. And that when we, you know, Lao Tzu said, the reason he didn't want to write down the Tao Te Ching was because he was worried that people would turn it into a religion. It is not a religion. Taoism is a philosophy. You should not use it as a religion. That was what the founder of it said. But and he's like, as soon as I write this down, people are going to treat this book like it's gospel, and it is not. It's advice. Mm-hmm. And it's a way for you to process the world. And so I find Taoism fascinating for those reasons. But again, so the principle of it, but then, you know, flash forward and there's Taoists like, reading this line must mean this, and we got to go kill these people. You're like, wait, this is the guy who's like stick in the river guy. Where is kill anybody? He's like, just float on past it. So whether it's religion or philosophy or politics or whatever, you said it perfectly. This is a book that is a warning about power. And I love the image you create that like, this original one was nice and it had good intentions. And then someone was like, ooh, what if I manipulate that or change this one word? And my new version of it is slightly darker. And now my new version of that is slightly darker. So this thing that was bad seems good. Like George W. Bush, in comparison to Donald Trump for lots of people, is a hero. But when George Bush was the least popular president in history when he left office. But now people are like,
whole album on it.
What's that?
But No Effects did a whole album on how much they hated Bush. Right. How Bush was the worst president ever.
Correct. And so did Green Day, right? So did everybody. Right? Yeah. So you're absolutely right. So there's this whole thing about George W. Bush. President Bush hates black people. Remember that during the Hurricane Katrina? All of this stuff happened and people believed that. And were like, he's the worst. And then they're like, Trump happens. And people are like, oh, Bush was great. Bush wasn't great. But you think he was great because you think this new thing is somehow worse. And it's just such an interesting commentary from this book. I had all these thoughts while I was reading this book.
And that's the best. And that's why I wanted you to read this book.
I appreciate that.
But, you know, power, government, even religion, it's all the interpretation of the person that's reading it and how they use that interpretation.
Sure.
And that's what it all comes to. You look at the monks in this book, you look at televangelists in real life, it's all about the interpretation of what they gain from it. And the fact that you can read this graphic novel that you can finish in one day and come out with all these aspects to think about says a lot about this book that, according to the inscription, I'm the only person that talks about.
Well, now two people have talked about it, and we'll get some listeners, and we'll tweet it out, this will come out, and people will be like, this is my book. And that's why we didn't want to spoil too much, because I really want people to go out and get it. Hopefully this will encourage Pell to get a digital copy out for my British friends.
Right.
Get a PDF. Pell, we need a digital copy. Anyway, yes, say what you need to say, please. I'm sorry.
We didn't talk about Falhern. Was that his name? The magician?
Yeah, Falhern, the wizard, the dark wizard.
A lot gets revealed about the magic of the world through him, and you don't even realize the extent or the what he personally goes through to still be doing magic, or just his whole arc of what of the darkness that's living inside the magic is doing to people who use magic. You keep getting hints of it and stuff, and you think you understand, but you don't understand at all the what he gives up to the story just to be there to help protect them. Just the thought of him putting a invisible dome up for them. Like, by the end of the book, you're like, what did that do to him?
Right.
Because, or like when the beast is flying around. And like, it's just, there's so many aspects of this book that really make you think. The, like I said, no one gives stuff away. When they fell to the ground and they couldn't get that thing out of there because of the thing in the sky, and you find out that's an old god that has made it to the new dark god, one of them, in physical form. You're like, what's its real form?
Right. Like, what must it look like?
Like, what's that sound it's making? And then you find out there's languages in the world that, if spoken, could melt your brain. And you're like, what language was that that is causing this to happen? Like, there's so much.
Well, that, to me, that's a direct voice of God. Like, that's the whole, there's that in the New Testament where and that was, of course, the plot of the dogma. Kevin Smith's dogma, right? Alan Rickman's dogma. Character. Yeah, he's the voice of God. Yeah, because if parents, if humans hear the voice of God, it will kill them. So that was, I thought, a nod to that too, right? Of like that old, that was a direct relation to
the voice of God. I guess for some reason I had to, but it was, you would think that would be the voice of a God that was up ahead of them, but not in its physical form. So maybe its voice wasn't as powerful.
Or it lost power because, and that goes back to Neil, American Gods, where the thing is, the less you believe, like belief matters. And actually, if you've been reading Department of Truth, James the Fourth's Department of Truth.
I haven't been, but I see it all the time. Everyone's talking about it.
It's pretty, well, it's not for everybody for sure. But what I love about it is that everything in that book is predicated solely on belief. So the more people believe it, the more likely it is to be true.
Oh, so what I'm trying to think of, the Earth X, Universe X series.
I've not read that.
It's one of my favorite series in all of Marvel, but essentially it's like a history lesson of the Marvel universe written by Kurt Busiek and drawn by Alex Ross. But Alex Ross does the covers of it. It's drawn by, artist I want to say Doug Braithwaite.
That's
an artist that recently died.
Okay.
And I'm losing his name all of a sudden, but something Anderson. Anyway, it's a beautiful book, but it's through the eyes of Uatu trying to train Machine Man to be the new watcher through time. And it just starts, then all of a sudden the world is dying and that peers have to have an alternate earth they create or universe they create. And it all becomes a belief thing. If you believe that you are this thing, you become this thing, and that they are a supreme race of aliens that just have complete control of their physical forms now. Like Thor is only Thor because he believes he's Thor. Loki's only Loki because he believes he's Loki.
Nice.
Like it becomes this huge all-encompassing saga. I love it.
Add it to the list. I've got Marvel Unlimited, so I'll be able to grab that, no problem.
I believe it's all on Marvel Unlimited.
Yeah. Nice.
But it's EarthX itself has appendices in between each thing that it's a lot like in between each chapter. It's not like the pages in here that's just the text written. Mm-hmm. And it's always appendices are always a conversation between two characters that delve you more into certain aspects of the world. It's very good. It's very, very good. But you got to have a knowledge of Marvel characters
because
every character pretty much gets used in this book.
Well, they do that a lot. That's a big Marvel thing. Yeah. I think people who only know the movies and they try to they go pick up the Civil War comic. They're like, holy shit. Who are all these people? I didn't know they were, because the Civil War comic has everybody. And if you're only watching the movie, you wouldn't know that. I mean, not that the Civil War movie didn't have too many characters in it, but like the comic is a whole other animal and, you know, Daredevils and, you know, everybody's in it.
So
anyway, I don't want to get too, we're not here to talk about that. Anyway.
Sorry, yes. I said Kirk Busiek. I meant Jim Kruger and Paul Leon. John Paul Leon was the artist. He recently died.
Nice.
It's
okay.
Beautiful. And I don't know why I said Kirk Busiek. Jim Kruger.
We were talking about him earlier.
I know. And it was just in my head.
Yeah.
That's totally fair. It's EarthX series. EarthX, Universe X, Paradise X. I couldn't recommend it more if you're a Marvel fan, because you're essentially getting a history lesson, which I love.
That's cool. Yeah.
The other history of DC Universe that's out right now reminds me of it.
That's a history beautiful. Lesson. I love that book.
I love that book too.
That's written a lot like this too. Same thing.
It is. That's why I hooked into the other history of DC so much, because it reminded me so much of EarthX, the way, because it's written through the perspective of the characters.
Yeah.
Only this is a gut punch. Other history is just a gut punch that people need, like you need to hear. Like,
yeah,
it's so good.
It is. It's written very much like this, though. It's written in the same way where it's like, it's because it's written by a screenwriter. So he's not writing comics. He's like, here's a story. I'm going to have these amazing artists tell the story. Malin Bumblebee, that was a great one, because I read those original Teen Titans when I was a kid.
I love those books too. And that one was my favorite so far out of them. I just got the one question. I love the question. So I'm looking forward to
it. I like Katana though. So it's tough. They're all good. Yeah.
They are.
Actually, I'm going to bring this back around. And again, this has nothing to do with season's end. I want to come back to that. But earlier when you were talking about Jim Lee, and I just said Katana, did you see, it was like 3 years ago during the, they were doing reboots of everything and he was doing the Suicide Squad covers. And there's this cover of Suicide Squad where it's Katana and she's holding the blade up, and in the reflection of blade is Croc's mouth, Killer Croc's mouth.
Uh-huh, yeah.
That is so goddamn awesome. I love that. I want, like, if I could just have a wall-sized poster of just that cover, it was like, that was Jim Lee. And, you know, he's never lost a step. There's just like that one picture tells so many things. And, you know, good art does that. And Wheeler does that in this book. So anyway, I'm going to leave all this stuff in the show because I love a good rambling conversation. But that's because a book like this can take you everywhere. So the final question before you promote yourself and tell everybody how they can have you comment on comics online is, who is this for? The last question is always, you recommended it to me. So who's the kind of person that should be reading Season End?
Well, I think everybody should read it. If you're a comic fan, you should read it. If you're an art fan, you should read it, because Blake's imagery is just as important as Pell's words in this book. If I'm talking to somebody online and they seem like they like to read, you know, because it's not a comic, it's a graphic novel. If they seem like they're people who only are interested in comics or something, I might not recommend it to them. If it's fantasy fans, if it's people I've talked to that reads Dungeons and Dragons books like me, that reads Dragonlance books like me, then I recommend it, because I feel the magic and the religion aspects of this book. And Adriel, as you pointed out at the very beginning, before I even got to talk about it, is such a good aspect of the female characters in that book. And even the magic in this book, they at one point they say the wizard that or the mage, whatever you want to call him, he knows all of his spells and stuff like that. In the Dragonlance series, to be a magician or to be a wizard, no matter what kind, it's like being a musician. You can go to school about it. You can learn all about it. But if you don't do it every day and memorize it, you're not going to be able to do it on the day. So the wizards in that book are constantly studying. They always have their books out there constantly studying their spells, because if they don't keep it finely tuned, they lose it. Just like, so I always think of it like playing the guitar, playing some kind of instrument. And that is this, like, it's so connected to the way that he writes the magic in this book. I feel like if people like that kind of stuff, then they'd really be into this. Plus, horror fans,
right? Well, that's because he crosses so many variants. I think you're right on all of those. I agree. I think if you are a person who even if you're like, I like all the things fantasy could be, but I always get nervous about the way that you know, the creepy, leery women stuff. Mm-hmm. That makes me uncomfortable. That's your book.
It's one of the reasons, and I'll be honest with you, why I haven't read Red Sonja so much, was because
is that way. Yeah.
I feel like a complete creep. It's how I felt about Lady Death when I was younger, too. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to be the kid walking around with that in my hand, like, in middle school, and be like, what are you looking at for? I don't want to be like, here's the stories.
And here's the thing.
The articles.
Those Gail Simone books, Jenny Frison does the covers. And so she's like one of the best cover artists. I don't know. And so they're pretty stunning. And so people would definitely be like, what's up with that? I mean, mm-hmm. She's Jenny Frison is like the spiritual granddaughter of Alex Ross. And, you know, like she's so photorealistic and so
perfect. I have the covers. Like, I can think of the covers from Gail's series in my head. Like,
pretty amazing. But I would just say, if you get a chance, read that omnibus, 18 issues. She definitely, and her introduction about why she loves that. So if you love the Gail Simone Red Sonja, read this book too, because it's the same idea where Gail saw those early Red Simone books and was like, hey, there's a redheaded girl. I'm a red, you know, like this mm-hmm. is this powerful. So like she found the positive in those original Red Sonjas, which weren't always there, to be fair.
Yeah.
Because the Conan stuff, same guy who created John Carter of Mars. There's a lot of, you know, that like that kind of icky stuff. And so while she still dresses like the Red Sonja that with the mesh bikini that barely covers everything, she's still somehow, it's irrelevant by the time the book is over. That's what makes it so amazing. It's like, oh, I've forgotten that she's wearing.
It's kind of my favorite thing in some things. It's there, but it doesn't need to be mentioned, or it doesn't need to be made a thing.
Yeah.
Like, I have no problem with like hypersexualized characters.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't have to be the aspect of their character or
however. Right.
Like, I've blunked her from my head so much that I don't even care about her. The X-Men, who was a porn star that just Jenny X, I think was her name.
Oh, okay.
Jenny X. And it was. She got used during the terrible, terrible X-Men, Chuck Austin's X-Men.
Okay.
And she was just unbearable in it. And I think at one point she goes to her room to masturbate and you never see her again. Like, but it had to be said, that's why she was going to her room. Like, what's the point? Like, just because she was a porn star does not mean that.
Yeah, that's silly.
Her whole character, like, you're hypersexualizing an X-Men. She's literally on the team living in this mansion with all these kids.
Like, that's dumb. Yeah, I can honestly say I didn't read that, so I'm glad. Thanks for saving me from going to find that.
Don't, it's terrible.
Yeah, I won't.
And I love X-Men. I stick with X-Men and read it through the years. Even right now, I'm still reading it, and there's just some terrible X-Men runs, and that's the only one I told people don't read. It's just so bad to
me. That's fair.
As a huge X-Men fan, my whole life.
Well, that's important. No, I will definitely avoid that. But that's who I think. So I would definitely recommend, you know, to the people who like that, who like Gales. And Mark Russell did a run on Red Sonja, which is pretty funny because it's Mark Russell. He can't help but be funny. but it's really good. I like Gales' run. It it changed the way I saw that character. And I would not have picked it up if it had not been Gail Simone.
All it takes is a good writer or a good team to just.
And I trust Gail. In Gail, we trust her run on Batgirl. I mean, her run on Batgirl. Come on.
I mean, I'll just Secret Six is all. I mean, so good. And
she's the queen. If you're not
no one cared about Knockout before Secret Six.
Before Gail was like, watch this. Yeah. So if you're not following Gail.
It's one of my favorite things.
If you're not following Gail on Twitter, really, what are you missing? She's amazing.
If you don't like Gail's writing, follow her on Twitter.
She's hysterical. Hilarious. I know. God, she's awesome.
She's the best troll I've ever seen in my life.
She just destroys everybody. I know. But you, let's tell everybody where they can find you on Twitter.
My handle is @CommentComics, or my name is iCommentOnComics. That's literally all I do. I had a Twitter that was just me. For myself, and it's still there. I think I have 30 followers, and that's about it. Then I just decided I want to start talking about comic books, and certain people in my family who are on my Twitter said they were tired of me seeing me talk about comic books, so I started my own I Comment on Comics, and I pretty much just lurk around on conversations, and I comment when I want
and you to. Do, and it's great, and that's how we met, and so I'm thrilled to have met you in real life. This is, well, in real life through Zoom. This is exciting.
But I try to say everything's positive normally. I don't get in on the bashing. I don't do the, I hate the better than, less yeah. than tweets and stuff. I try not to get in on any of that. And I try to lift people up more than anything, or help people out here and there if I can, if there's any way I can. Somebody that I didn't mention to you earlier when I was talking about somebody, I'd mentioned how good the Nighthawk series was. And he had never heard it, so I just sent it to him because he'd never heard of it before. And I've read it so many times, you know, I've got it in my head. I just wanted to see the Steve Dillon art in it. Like, the Steve Dillon.
Oh,
like,
man. His
Joker character in that Nighthawk series is so creepy. And, like, this dude just has to see that. And it's not in print. So I was like, I'll send it to you, man. Like, that's all I'm about. I'm just about people reading good comics and teaching me about comics I never gave a chance, or just talking me into reading a comic, you know, like that guy that I sent that to talked me into getting Ultra Mega, and that was probably one of the best things.
I love Ultra Mega. What a mess. There are these new kaiju books, so there's that, there's Jenny Zero, which is also
Jenny Zero is another one he's trying to get me to get.
That's a good one too. And
I like Kaiju Max, Xander Cannon's Kaiju Max is
Beast,
but it's more lighthearted.
Well, there was Jason Howard's Big Girls, which was a total spin on the Kaiju. I loved that's actually still my favorite, but Jenny Zero has this weird, subtle charm to it that I'm enjoying. I think that's only a four-parter, and Ultra Mega is only a four-parter. So those have been a delight. So cool. Well, that is great. Thank you for coming on. I have appreciated
this. Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, we'll do this again. We'll do this again with something that's a little more, it's still indie, but more well-known, so we can spoil the shit out of it. So we'll plan on that. So everybody can follow me. I'm on Twitter @TricycleBoombox. If you want to suggest a topic like Chase did today, that's why we covered this, because he suggested this one. Follow me there. Follow Gail Simone, everybody. Make sure you subscribe to Comics in Motion. And if you don't, if you're not on Twitter, you can send me a message through my website, which someone did who was a guest. So that was cool. Arfarina.com. You can send me a message there if you're not on Twitter, because I'm not on the other social medias.
Hey, one more. He's not on Twitter much, but Jason Pell is @Dexel. I believe it's DEXXELL.
Okay.
He's not on there a lot. He's mostly on Facebook. You can find him, Jason Pell, on Facebook or Bughouse Comics. Contact him on there. If you're interested in any of the books, he will sign it for you and send it to you directly. He's
I tried. I'm not on Facebook, so I couldn't connect with him there.
Right. But again, definitely connect him on there. I do not know. I tried before this to look up to see if Blake had a Twitter or anything. I do not know if he does or not, but you can find he has an art. If you Google him, you can go to his art, and he's got some great stuff on there.
And I'll put all those links in the show notes, so everybody will just link on those stuff and go to Bughouse, support independent comics. Thank you, Chase. I appreciate you, man. This was awesome.
Oh, no, thank you so much. I appreciate it too. It was a lot of fun.